three, two, one, and we're back, ladies and gentlemen, with another episode of the Bedroom to Boardroom podcast, where we delve into the stories of people from underrepresented backgrounds. The focus is always the guest, but I'm the host for today's episode, AJ. So without further ado, let's get started.
So like, especially if you're a black person in the corporate world, right, you're always tested. I always say this to my friends, that you have times, and there's always like a moment where it's like, oh gosh, do I do this or do I not do this? And it's very much sort of a test of exactly who you are, your character. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people do want to go down, you know, saying truth to themselves, etc., but then they feel like they could lose their job, they have so much at stake, that they kind of like make themselves small. And I think that's such a difficult thing to navigate, especially if you're like, because I work with people who are newly into the world of work, and they just, it's just something that you struggle with. And I think a lot of the times, like one of my areas of interest is mental health, especially mental health within the black place, as it kind of like pertains to like black, Asian, minority, ethnics, especially looking at black women. And I feel like a lot of the things that we go through, especially within the workplace, is actually linked to kind of having heightened levels of anxiety. And I think, and it leads back to what you're saying, it's kind of like just trying to go back to what you're saying, is it definitely boils down to the fact that you find yourself in very compromising situations, to where you don't feel like you have the agency to either speak up for yourself. We feel like if I do speak up for myself, what's the outcome going to be?
So I can tell you some interesting stories, especially around the like first job. So graduated 2017, went into procurement. Like, I had no idea what the fuck procurement was.
Yeah.
I just applied. The salary was like quite lucrative. I got to work from home a couple of days a week. I thought I was lit.
It works out for you, right?
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. So I go to these events, you know, again, it's the idea of, you know, working or being around, you know, middle-aged, like Caucasian people is something that was a new experience to me. And as silly as that sounds, you're normally around people who are like your age mates. So you can banter. But again, you have a few different variables at play. You have one, it's people who aren't your age mates. Two, you're in a professional setting, so you can't quite be yourself. And thirdly, you don't know what self to be, what mask to put on in this environment. So I found myself like wearing all different types of masks. And I remember one stage, I was like, yo, fuck this shit. I was at a company event. and everyone was sat down talking about their mortgages and holiday, and I'm 21 years old. I don't have a fucking mortgage. I don't care.
Yeah, he's like, whatever.
Yeah. And I was like, yo, fuck this shit. And then that was one example, and I've had some terrible ones where you're in an office, people are making these like dog whistle remarks.
And you
realize what they're implying, but they're not saying it. One of them,
they're not saying it. Yeah.
But like knife crime in London, and whenever you hear those, you know who's being alluded to. So these people. Because I tend to have bad posture, so I slouch on my chairs quite a
time. Okay.
So they're speaking about knife crime in London, and they're speaking about how it's, you know, a lack of father figures, the homes are terrible, and I peek up and I say, you're making an assumption based upon things that aren't as simple as they seem to be. There's a lot of variables at play here, and in the way these guys just went pim, kept quiet.
Did they say nothing?
No. And then when I tried to make this remark to the HR department, the pace at which they dealt with it was like terrible. Secondly, I took a step back and I realized, wow, cool, I'm the new person in this organization. I'm the only black person in this organization. These people here have been in the company for like 5-10 years. One of the guys here is a top biller doing £1 million in revenue per year. Are they really going to fire this guy because of what I said?
Yeah.
Answer is no. So guess who left and guess he's still at that company to this very day.
It's just, do you know what? There's so many situations like that though. And I think it's really hard as well, especially as you're saying, when you start young, you know, because I deal with new grads a lot. And I think I do a lot of coaching and training in regards to like unconscious biases. I work in a lot of tech companies and small startup businesses, and I contract and I deliver training basically. And then kind of like my day-to-day is like the lead on university recruitment and D&I specialist, which basically just means that I manage MAR and I look at like different recruitment in different regions. Well, it's kind of global at the moment. It's not just MAR, because I was doing it in Israel as well. And we were looking at kind of like the racism and the structures within those particular countries and how that trickles down to people that work within the workforce and what that looks like, and is it representative? So it's a lot of like statistics, it's a lot of analysis, and it's not always like glitter and gold. It's kind of hard because we already know, and this is something that is very prevalent within the UK, we know that racism exists, but if you say racism exists, it's as if you're saying the sky is orange. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. we know, but it's sometimes difficult to quantify to people because it's not as overt as it is in places like America, for example, where somebody will call you the N-word. You know, so you're just like, oh, well, that's racist, and kind of pinpoint it. But it's those snidey remarks, it's those kind of like under the table things that are said that you know it's happening, but you can't, like, it's not tangible enough. You feel like, I can't grip onto this. I can't call it for what it is. And I think that that is so hard, especially when you're navigating the workforce at such a young age, because you can feel it, but often you can't make sense of it until the moment's gone. So I speak to a lot of people about that. I had experiences like that when I started out, because I was spoiled. I worked for my first job out of university was I worked for a company called Windsor Fellowship, mm-hmm. and the whole point of Windsor Fellowship was to provide Black, Asian, minority, ethnic people with roles in really big like government organisations and okay. really big like the NAO and then like BAE Systems and the Bank of England. So like big names, right? Where we're underrepresented, and they kind of established needs within these companies. So it was more collaborative, mm-hmm. because they knew our job was to get Black and Asian minority ethnics within their organizations because they knew that they didn't already exist. But the person that was doing that was me. And I think what's interesting is that you will find that a lot of people that work within the diversity and inclusion space don't look like me. They're white, which is strange.
It's confusing. So I'd love to spend some time on this. So I spent the whole of the last summer cold calling companies to try to onboard them onto Spieler, and the amount of times I experienced this would be, you reach out on LinkedIn to diversity managers of, you know, let's say Sainsbury's, for example, and you look, and in your mind it's like, who would be best suited to understand how diversity and inclusion works,
right?
And then it's always, I mean, and again, I've met some really wonderful people in these positions, so I don't mean to speak negatively on them.
Yes.
It's always some like middle-aged Caucasian woman. Sarah, Susan, Betty.
Karen. Yeah. Karen. It's always Karen. I'll tell you something.
And then, you know, listen, I have conversations with people. I've met some, I meet them at events. They're very nice. And
yeah. I really very think, pleasant. Like,
they're progressive in their ideology. But
yes.
When it comes to execution, there is that, you know, unconscious bias being at play. And when people hear diversity in a workforce, I think in most cases, they just think women and Caucasian women.
And that's so true.
And I'm with that for sure. I think, you know, putting everybody in position is very important. But mm-hmm. when we have these people who aren't representative of ourselves, our genders don't necessarily align with theirs, and we get pushed to the back of the pecking order.
I think a big thing to be said about that as well is because we have to define what diversity and inclusion actually even is, because ethnic diversity is something that we should stand alone. And then even within ethnic diversity, we need to kind of like wrap that up and kind of like unwrap it and see that like Black and Asian people do not go through, like, it's not a monolithic thing, like there's nuances within our experiences, mm-hmm. and I think that that's really important to note, and that's something that I'm really trying to push. Like, a Black person does not necessarily go through the same type of racism as an Asian person. It's just it's two different experiences, and that's why I kind of struggle with the term BAME, because it's lumping two ethnicities together who are 100% within their right, minorities, 100% in their right within London, if we're looking specifically within London, do kind of like occupy the underprivileged areas, and that we know that that trickles down to kind of like social economic opportunities and schooling and catchment areas. It 100% valid, right? But our experiences are so different. And I think that that's really important to note, because what you'll find is that when I've gone into like small startups and so on, there's Asian people. Like, there's Asian mm-hmm. people working within these startups, and they're like, oh, well, I've ticked the box then. I've got one type of minority. And it's like, wait, hold on, no. And also the way that we're socialized is different. There's so much that comes into play in that. And I think that often companies, because I'm looking at it from more of a business standpoint, mm-hmm. companies love to apply, and the Karens and the Susans, of course, really progressive, and sometimes they have great ideologies, but I think when you're not having that lived experience, you apply simple solutions to really complex, you know, situations mm-hmm. and really complex issues, because you believe that, you know, this will work. And I feel like unless you're kind of like, you have direct experience with what that feels like, sometimes it's really hard to look at the issue for what it is. because again, not all of what we deal with is tangible. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So two different viewpoints on this, and the first is, so in essence, there's jargon language being used, anecdote, which is a seat at the table.
Yeah.
And like for a long period of like, I guess my working career, I was an advocate for that. My idea was like, yeah, sure. Like you work hard and you try and break down these barriers and have a seat at the table in order to then, you know, provide opportunities for people from your background, from your community. However, as I'm exposed to it a bit more, I do see the fallacy in ideology. And I look just sweepingly at different industries and I really try to find any concrete evidence of where this has worked. Like where these companies who have from the very inception been created to benefit the needs of the very few, in this case, white supremacy, why would they suddenly decide to change the structure by which they operate on to be accommodating to others? And in essence, they won't unless they're forced to, which has led me to a different ideology now, which is, instead of, you know, begging, pleading for humanity to be acknowledged by these companies, by these entities, it's time to, you know, do for self. Instead of being so reliant upon these companies. For example, when I was ringing these companies in the summer, you'd speak to the CEO, because again, like small companies, 0 to 50, maybe 0 to 15 headcount.
Yeah.
Speak to the CEO. I do my research. I'm on the LinkedIn. I'm on the Sales Navigator. I see the company demographics. It's there's no black people. Like it's all like white middle-aged men, or sometimes there's startups in like Shoreditch. So they're like, you know, 20 to 30-year-old like Caucasian men and women. You ring them up and like, hey guys, love what you're doing. I think it'd be great to have a conversation about diversity. And they cut you off. They're like, diversity? No. We're okay on that front.
Yeah.
And you look at their LinkedIn, see of Caucasian, and they're not okay. And I spent the whole summer doing this, and these same conversations along the same sentiment being echoed. And it was to some degree like quite deflating. You're like, oh fuck. Like, and you take a step back and you realize what I'm just doing is justifying to these people begging, like, hey master, please, you know, employ me.
Yeah.
In essence. And I realized that that's not the approach. The correct approach is to play the corporate game, so to speak. Develop your own skill set so that you can take it away and actually implement initiatives outside of the traditional method to actually help bring your community forward.
Yeah, I think that kind of, well, the thing is, I think that I'm very nuanced in this because I believe and I know that you can have two actions leading to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we do both? So I think that, I think it's something that always comes up, like with that police force and like institutions that are kind of put there to oppress black people, right? And there's always the argument of, oh, and this is relates to this because it's the argument of, you know, we shouldn't work for the police because we're black or we're Asian, etc. I do believe that you can create change within systems, and I believe that you can create change outside of systems. And I think that both are needed and necessary. And the reason why I think that is because I believe that we're not all the same. Like where everybody works differently. Not everybody kind of has the skill set, as you noted, like having the skill set or the ambition or the hard work that it takes to kind of work outside of the system and create change. But I believe that we're needed in every aspect that we can to create change. And there's not one way. I think that there's more than one way. And I think also what you said about a seat at the table, I definitely am from the school of like, if you're not on the menu, what is the saying? It's something about like, if you're not on the menu, like if you're not on the table, you're on the menu.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. If you're not on the table, then you're on the menu. So I feel like you need to be in a space where you can create change. And I don't mind how that change is created. Because for example, for me, I create it inside of systems, but I also create it outside of systems. Mm-hmm. So outside of systems through my contract work, outside of systems through my advocacy, outside of systems through empowerment of like the schools that I kind of go to, the outreach work that I do, the community work that I do, but I also create inside of systems like one of the companies I work for at the moment, where I was the only black person who worked for that company. I've been there for like, I think 7 months. I've employed 4 other black people who are young, who are really hungry. And being in that company, I haven't seen anything which kind of suggests that, oh my gosh, it's one of kind of the easiest places I've had to work in regards to like race and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I haven't had any negative experiences personally yet, and that is very rare for me to say, by the way, like, very rare. So it seems to have quite a good culture. But at the same time, there's a study that happened in Spain, and it said that there was this, I think it was a small startup, it was a tech startup, and it had been, well, I say small tech startup, it'd been around for about 15 years, and it was predominantly white middle-class men who worked in this startup, and they knew that they needed to create change, but they didn't know how to do it. So they had like counseling, and they went through like this counseling thing, which is a very kind of strange alternative route, but okay, to look at like unconscious bias in. And then they also had consultants that came in and said, okay, put two women on the hiring board, just put two recruiters in bad recruiters and see what happens. And within 2 years, literally the numbers of like gender equality went up, it soared. And I think sometimes people think, and this is again through my work, speaking to senior members, they believe that good looks like them, because they know that they're good. And I've heard this, like, oh, good looks like me. So when I employ people, these are hiring managers that have the power, yeah, and the authority to employ people, and they have the understanding in their head, the unconscious bias, that good looks like me. So they don't see outside of that. So when they do go and employ people, they just employ people that look like them, that speak like them, that have similar backgrounds to them. And we all have unconscious biases. So I think that sometimes it's not so much begging for a seat at the table, sometimes it's educating. But I don't think it's every Black person's job to educate people on, you know, how to act. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not on us. But there's some people who are happy to take on that role. And I think that that is necessary. Because if we're looking for, at the end of the day, I'm somebody who kind of stands on the hill and says that I have like a different standpoint, because again, I'm not really for integration, mm-hmm. but I know in order for us to get to a place of where we don't have to integrate, we have to integrate to begin with.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Let's focus on this. So
yeah,
I'm with you on the ideology of not being for integration.
Yeah,
and it sounds counterintuitive. Yeah. No, it's actually been detrimental to our
100% people. 100%. 100%. I'm not for integration. I believe that we have to integrate in order to get to the place that we have the power to not have to integrate. And mm-hmm. I believe that that's important, because the power structures and the things that are at play are, like, come on, we have to understand that we do live in a white man's world, whichever way we want to look at it, that's mm-hmm. just what it is. But I don't think that we always have to live in a white man's world, but I think that we need to utilize it. It's what you said, navigate it, get what you need to get out of it, and then get out. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? The reason that I'm not for integration is because the problem that Black people have, especially, I'm going to say specifically looking at within London and across the world, is that we live in underprivileged areas, right? Where we don't have social economic opportunities. We don't have the same opportunities that our white counterparts do in different areas. Now, if we have the same schooling, you know, the same social economic opportunities, the same job opportunities, the same opportunities to kind of like get fresh food, even small little things, if our areas mimicked the areas that white people occupy, I am telling you now, we would not have to integrate. I think integration is a trap. I think that you're seeing it now within areas like Peckham, where they're talking, like, where there's gentrification and there's integration, but really it's not, it's said it's integration, but it's not integrating people. What it's creating is white people coming to our areas, taking, it's colonization in the 21st century, really. I don't even know why I'm trying to like make it out like it's something else. So yeah, I'm not for integration, but I believe in order for us to get to where we need to get to, we have to use the systems in place in order to create. Do you know what I mean? Nothing is like instant or overnight, so we need to integrate first in order for there to be no integration. We can't just say now, okay, we're not going to integrate. What do we have? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. We have to get to a place where we have.
My thoughts on this is, when you see integration, in essence, what it really is, it's just assimilation. So
there's
two opposing ideologies, and when you go head to head, in essence, like, one of them will prevail. And in terms of integration, the ideology that prevails, it's never our own.
Yes. Yeah.
This is 100%. What we see the byproduct of. For example, I used to be in Lewisham, where I moved to. I'm probably part of the problem, to be fair. Like, you look around and, like, this is Lewisham. Like, I mean, I was born and raised in Southeast London.
Yeah, same.
I moved to Lewisham, and in my mind, I hadn't been to Lewisham in a while. I was expecting something. I walk around and I'm near the new block of flats, and I didn't even see a Black person where I lived, apart from myself, which is weird.
Yeah, because which is, I'm in Lewisham. Especially Lewisham, yeah.
When I go to Peckham, when I go to this party, and on the rooftop bar, I go upstairs and everything is pink, and I think, wow. I remember being young. I remember, I won't say what I did. I remember being in, like, in this area for not good reasons. And it was different. And I think, like, now what's changed? And now you're seeing, you know, you speak to some of the locals, people being forced out of their properties because mm-hmm. they can't afford rent. Mm-hmm. There's talks about, you know, new buildings being built and them having to be moved from where they live. And, you know, in essence, already people are in, like, marginalized, underserved communities, and now they're being forced out where?
Yep.
And it's also it's with the battle of ideologies, especially the white supremacy. What I do see, and why I said that, this going back to the early point, like the seat at the table wasn't really effective, is in essence that is just symbolism. And I feel as if, you know, many people get, you know, lost in this source of assimilation, like, yeah, I'm going to join this company, I'm going to work my way up, but you just lose yourself. And then you have that, you know, that symbolic, you know, in the US, it's the symbolic black president who's done nothing to improve the lives of black
people
in the US. Or in the UK, you have, you know, the chief diversity officer of the KPMG or insert, you know, large institutional company, who in essence has done very little. And, you know, in most cases, you see them with their partner who's outside of the culture. And you realize that, oh, wow, like, if this is a battle of ideology, like, we've lost for a few reasons. Like, one, many people don't even really understand the intricacy of the game being played, or that there 100%. Is a game. Or in fact, you can go as far as to say, like, there's a war, actually.
There is a war, yeah.
People don't know we're in a war. That's why we keep losing. Because people think it's all shit sweet. It's not sweet at all.
Exactly. This is the thing, but I think it's also about who's put in those kind of situations and what they believe in, right? And their ideology. It's really important. And what you're speaking about as well, I think you're speaking to, like, gentrification. And you're speaking to the fact that it's dressed up. And so with integration, it's dressed up. In theory and practice, things look very different. It's dressed up like, oh my God, it's going to help black people. And, you know, we're going to create all of these opportunities. I'm so sorry, but there's... Where I get my head on in Peckham, where I used to get my head on in Peckham, actually, there's cafes literally right opposite, which are occupied by white people, and they employ white people to serve white people. That is what's happening, right? How is that beneficial to a place that has been known to be kind of like, to be occupied by Africans? Like, how is that beneficial to us? Like, how is that helping? Like, what? Because it's creating opportunities. Opportunities for who? That's the question you have to ask. Like, when we're looking at gentrification, when we're looking at integration, who is it creating opportunities for? And if it's not creating opportunities for us, then it's just not going to make any sense. I think that's really important.
I think most of the policies we see aren't, like, here to help us or to better us.
Yes.
And I think so. I met this amazing guy, and I hope he doesn't mind me saying his name, Dr. Frederick Laker. I met him at a sports event. And very, very, very well-read brother. And he recommended me a few books that I'll probably put in the cliff notes. And I've read them since. And
what
in
books
essence,
are they?
Shit.
Do you know
I think it's, yeah.
I read a lot. I think it's
Games My Mother Never Taught Me in regards to workplace dynamics for black women. And another book called, I think it's by Claude Anderson, I'm not too sure. Like, Why White Men Have All the Fun.
Okay.
I have to double check the names. But in essence, it's about the game, the war that we're at, and why we're losing is people don't know, because people have been brainwashed. In essence,
brainwashed, yeah.
Where people's 100%. Focus is on things that don't matter. So I
at all.
To my peers, and this is back to the assimilation point, where, like, you join these companies and
you end up assimilating.
Yourself.
Yeah,
exactly. You go to these events. I see friends who I knew were very pro themselves, and now 3-4 years being working at a company, they use language like we, like we.
There's no we.
Yeah,
there's
no we.
There's no we. There's absolutely no we.
It's
them and you.
Also, it's the trappings of, you know, like, what they see success as being. So success to them is you know, buying, or in most cases leasing or renting, that European, like, car, the BMW or the Benz. Or success is buying these European watches or the Rolexes, less or Cartier, but people aren't really buying anymore.
it's so true. It's so
going
true.
To Dubai, and you realize everybody's focused on, like, traveling across the world, and most of us hail from Africa.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to go back to Africa.
No one wants to go back there. Do you know what I think it is, though? It's all in the condition of white supremacy. It's all in the condition of, like, what we idolize and what we look at to be as the pillar of success, right? And that's what it boils down to. If you're successful, then you look like this. right? If you're successful, then you have these things. Does that make sense? So I think it's how Black people have idolized success and what it looks like to them. And it's different if you actually, the thing is, you, it's so hard, right? Because I think that I talk from a place of privilege when it comes to this, these type of topics. And I really try to make myself conscious and not like talk down, but just kind of uplift in the sense that for me, I always, always, always say that I was also one of, had that same kind of,
I was lost.
Do you know what I mean? I was also 100%. I had that thought process. Like, I was like, I need to get a Chanel bag. Oh, I hadn't even moved at my mum's house, by the way. I was like, I need to get this, I need to get that. But it was literally because you would turn on social media, you would turn on things, you would look at people on TV, and it's like, oh, they have this. And you, do you know what I really, 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 really like employ people to do, and I really want people to do this, is just actually step outside of yourself and ask yourself, why do I want what I want, and why do I think what I think? That is where it starts.
It's a powerful exercise.
Yes. Yes, like, that is where it starts. I went to, I think what saved me, and I always say this completely, had like, this was the point in my life where everything like changed for me. When I was at university, I studied anthropology and sociology. So again, privileged in the sense that I've always had this kind of like deep level of thinking. Like, I've always wanted to understand more about cultures. That's something that I've always been passionate about. I've always been somebody who's very rooted in, like, my mum would always say to us, like, outside of the UK, in this house is Uganda. Does that make sense? So I knew who I was. Does that make sense? I knew where I came from. And I think that was really powerful for me, because when it came to me doing a placement year, I had the opportunity to go to Colombia and obviously do anthropology work, because I wanted to kind of analyse, is the drug trade as bad as what people say? So that sounds really exciting, right? Or I had the opportunity to go to Uganda. And I had the opportunity to kind of do my own fieldwork, because obviously I'm Ugandan, I speak the language, I understand the language. So I've got a lot more leeway. And I think when I told people, they obviously were like, go to Colombia because, you know, the drug trade, it's fun, it's exciting, da, da, da. But I was like, no, actually, again, the point of privilege of, I love Uganda, I know where I'm from, I'm more connected to that. So I went to Uganda, and I tell you, it completely changed everything for me. Like, the way that I thought, the way that I looked at the world, what I was passionate about, how I understood social economic opportunities, how I understood that a lot of the verbiage, I used to be one of those people who used to say stuff like, oh, this makes me feel really sick. I used to say stuff like, oh, I shouldn't be upset because the poor kids in Africa are happy. Who told you that? Like, I used to be one of those girls. Like, and when I hear people say that, and like on these Instagrams, people are like, oh, you know, you see the dances, like black orphans dancing. By the way, kids that live underneath the poverty line, kids that don't know when their next meal is going to come. Oh, because they're dancing and they can dance. Oh my God, these kids are so happy. How dare we be upset? And it's like, wow, I used to think like you. Like, I used to really think that. Like, I used to say stuff like, oh, I better eat my food because look at the starving kids in Africa. Who taught me to think like that? That was for me like the biggest change and shift in my life. What you say and what you think holds so much value, and it has so much importance, because the thing is, you internalize that. And when you internalize it, you start to think that, oh, you start to dehumanize black bodies. And I think that's where it starts. We dehumanize ourselves by dehumanizing people that look like us. You start to say things like, oh, this person's happy. You wouldn't say that about a child that was in a child center in Bethnal Green. You wouldn't say that. You wouldn't say, oh, look at that poor starving kid from Iraq who's in Bethnal. Look at that poor refugee in Bethnal Green. You would never say that. Oh, look how happy they are because they were smiling on the camera. Because we haven't been internalized, like, we haven't been brainwashed to think that that kind of verbiage is okay. But we have for African kids. And I think that kind of ideology and the way that you think, it feeds into what you deem as successful. It feeds into where you want to go once you've kind of created a life for yourself. It feeds into how you see and perceive Africa. Does that make sense? So I think you have to start from the root of really like unlearning a lot of the things that we've been conditioned, brainwashed to learn and to think is important. And that's one thing that I always push with my younger cousins, through my work, through advocacy, through when I go to speak to people in Cambridge. Like, I always talk to them like the power of, why do you think the way that you think, and why do you like want what you want? You know what I mean?
Life is a journey of like unlearning these like negative behaviors and 100%. ideologies. So I had one moment which like stands out to me, and only because I was reading a book that kind of summarized this, and even reading the book didn't quite help it. So that's how brainwashed I was. It was autobiography by Malcolm X.
Yeah, Red Hughes.
Yeah, in the book he talks about the slaves in Lansing who dress up in clothes that to replicate the wealthy middle class, the black bourgeoisie in Harlem. So yeah. During this moment of time, I was like, I had just hit my sales target. I'd even gone to the watch dealership.
Oh, so you had your commission coming in. You was a big baller.
I was lit.
You was a big baller.
I put a watch on my wrist. The gentleman came in. Yo, he saw a sucker. He knew what he saw. He saw.
He knew.
Finesse me. Yeah. I came in for the date just, you know, nice little like 3-4. He's like, nah, mate, don't. Not a date just, you know, you got to think, you know, investment piece. I'll be like, yeah, investment piece. Yeah, good. So you want the Explorer 2 or you want the Submariner? Like two grand more than what I budgeted for. But I was like, yeah. He's just try it on. So I try it on now. I'm like, oh, wow. I'm feeling myself. I walk out smug. I put a deposit the same day. Now, I go back on the commute home to read another chapter of the autobiography. Right. And I realize that, wow, I am just one of those dumb people in the book who are now trying to assimilate. And I was like, I can't believe I got lost in the sauce.
100%.
I can't believe I let myself get gassed. I can't believe I let him gas me too. It's dumb idiot. And now, you know, not, that shop is out of business now. I mean, unrelated to any of this. But then, again, it's the journey of like unlearning. So even with knowledge, you could still like fuck up to some, so to speak. It's about catching yourself in those moments. And I feel as if it's just a journey of, again, the point you mentioned, understanding like why you want what you want, why you think, how you think. And I think this time with quarantine is a great time to really sit down and, you know, retrospectively like break down your values.
Let's break it down. Like let's look at it. That is brilliant. I'm so happy that this kind of like podcast ended with, like kind of has been wrapped up on that, because that's like literally what I stand on. That changed my life. Like looking at unlearning everything that I learned, not just one thing, everything, like marriage, as it even pertains to like personal relationships, like my relationship with like why I want a guy. Do you know what I mean? Do I want a guy? Do you know what I mean? Do I want a boyfriend? Like do I want a husband? Like literally asking yourself things that you've always just assumed you've wanted. Like you have to want it. I mean, society says I need to have certain things. Like even I've got a house, right? So I've got a house in Reading. So why? Does that make sense? Like I had to really think about like, do you want, is it beneficial? Don't just go with what everybody's doing and what everybody, look at it for yourself and your own life. Does it make sense for Ivy's life? Not does it make sense for society? Not does society say you need to have certain things by the time I'm 28, so by the time you're 30. Do you want to have these things? Does it make sense? And I think that that's so powerful, because when you start operating I think when you start operating in regards to like, who you are and you own yourself, and if you have agency, you can navigate this world so much. You just it's liberating, like you're free. Does that make sense? So in my work, the reason why I believe that you can create change, again, is from a point of privilege. The reason why I think that I can create change inside systems and outside systems is because I know who I am. So nothing defines me. Does that make sense? And I'm at that point now. So in the sense that if I say something to somebody in a company and they don't like what I've said, or if they, that has nothing to do with me. I don't have to take that on, because I know who I am and I know what I'm saying and I know why I'm saying it. So whether this person likes it or not, I don't internalize it. So I think that kind of frees you from assimilating, because you don't feel the need that you have to. And I think we all do to some degree. I mean, like we wear weaves, you know what I mean? Like there's things that we do assimilate, right? But there's some things that are in our control. And there's some things that we have agency, we take power of. And I think when we understand what those things are, we can navigate freely. And nothing outside of us can really define who we are. Does that make sense?
I 100% agree. But before we leave, what I'd like to cover is currently, I mean, it's coronavirus. it's fucking the world up. How has your world changed based upon coronavirus? And let's say I am a university graduate still studying in my penultimate year, how should I approach the employment market with coronavirus?
Really good question, because I think a lot of people who are looking for jobs now, it's a big thing, right? And I think one of the top things that I would say, tangible advice, is virtual career fairs, virtual recruitment fairs, sign yourself up. You can go to like CV libraries as well, like virtual one-on-ones with career coaches who can kind of help you and coach you virtually. With calls like this, like on Zoom, in regards to like fixing up your CV, in regards to looking at what opportunities are available and what's going to be available, in regards to planning out and mapping out your career for like next year or whenever this thing completely ends and, you know, we can get back to work, etc. So I would say go online and literally sign up to all of the career fairs that you can, and always keep in mind that, you know, no situation is permanent, so this won't last forever. And then the second part, like, how has it affected me personally in regards to like my work life? Again, point of privilege, and I'm extremely fortunate and grateful for the fact that I can work from home, and it hasn't really changed in regards to like the way that I work. On a personal level, I'm a bit of a social butterfly, so I go out with the girls, I go for drinks, so I have obviously haven't been doing that. I think I'm quite an adaptable person, so it hasn't really affected me. But I will say one thing, it did in the beginning, in the sense that I didn't know, it's taught me something about myself. I didn't know I was as routined as well. I thought that I was more of a free spirit and I didn't need routine. I need routine. I was going down this thing of waking up and feeling like, oh, Ivy, like, you're just a bum. Does that make sense? Like, I would be waking up, my hair's a mess. Like, I'd just be rolling out of bed and I'd be just going on my Zoom call and I was just looking scruffy and I just didn't like it. It didn't make me feel good. So I created a routine for myself where I'd make myself my own coffee. I literally, like, 9:30 you do this, like, everything is kind of like routine. I know what times I'm doing things. I know when I'm eating lunch. I think that's important. I know what time I'm having a workout. That's helped me, and I didn't know that I needed that. And I think that's one thing that this whole virus and corona has taught me, is that, wow, like, you're somebody who does have a routine. You are one of those people. You are an adult. Do you know what I mean? Like, I am adulting, like, in practice. I didn't know that.
So yeah. In terms of, I mean, you've probably seen thousands of CVs at this moment.
Yes, loads.
So what are some of the main fuck-ups, blunders, mishaps that people make in their CVs that you'd love to, if you can give them 30 seconds to say, hey, change these one or two things, okay, and you won't get the job, but you'd be one step closer.
Okay. Auto-check, please. Like, everybody, auto-check. Like, I know it sounds so silly, but auto-check. I'm just like a kind, sweet person, right? So I'm kind of like, oh, this is what they meant. No, hiring managers are not like me, do you understand? So when I pass on your CV, sometimes I have the authority to kind of just bring you in for an interview, and I have even the authority to just hire you on the spot, right? But not all the time. So I might give you that grace, other people won't. So please, please, please check how you spell. It's not my strong suit, please do it. Number one, you would be so surprised how many mistakes people make in their CVs. Also, put a little bit of effort in your CVs in terms of layout and format. If you need that help, then you can email me directly. I'll let you know like what my details are and how you can get hold of me. But yeah, in terms of format, we're not in 1997, like, we are in the 21st century. Like, please, let's just fix our CVs, please. So that's the format and spelling.
Okay, you heard it, guys. Edit your format.
Edit it.
Make sure your spelling is correct.
Yeah. That's it, really. I think that's what I'd say.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Any
You're
closing
very
remarks?
Welcome. Yes, everybody keep safe. This won't last forever. And what else would I like to say? And make sure that you spend some time on learning what you've learned and learning what makes sense for you.
Yeah. Amen. And I would say go spend time with your family, hug them, yes, if you're fortunate enough to have them in your lives. You know, 100%. People's grandparents and mothers are passing away at a crazy rate. So
I know, yeah, of course.
Enjoy what you have, guys. Appreciate it.
Be grateful. Practice gratitude. It's really important. I mean, you don't have it as bad as, you know, you think you do. So and if you do have it as bad as, like, you know, you have loss, I hope that you have something that brings you comfort in times of uncertainty and you hold on to that. So yeah, sending all the love and light.
Wow, thank you for taking some time to listen to all of that. I really appreciate it. Feedback makes the world go round, so what I'd like for you to do is please give us a follow on Instagram, bedroom2b. That's our socials. Please give me some feedback as to how we can improve. Alternatively, message me on LinkedIn. So AJ, surname is Alpha Lima Alpha Oscar. Feedback makes the world go round, so I'm eagerly anticipating how we can make the next few episodes much better. Again, thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode.